Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gunnar Zindberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. My guest is Patrick Ness. He's the author of many books, but most prominently for this season, A Monster Calls, which is being released as a movie. And it's a fascinating movie. It brings up all kinds of emotional issues about monsters, about children's books, about how to talk about the things in childhood that are the most painful. And it won awards both as the best young adult novel that year, as well as for the best illustrations. These were British awards. It's rare for a book to win in both categories.
Indeed unique. It's the first one to do so.
It's wonderful. And when I read it, although the movie was the occasion, I found the book extraordinarily moving. And I wanted very much to talk about it. This book for you is something of an inheritance. Another writer began it, yes?
Yes, in an extremely unusual way to start a story, particularly for me, as someone who, you know, novelist by temperament, don't care for collaboration. But there was a wonderful British writer called Siobhan Dowd, who wrote four really terrific young adult novels. And she wrote them all knowing that she had terminal breast cancer. And she wrote them as quickly as she could. This was going to be her fifth book. She thought she would have time to write it. But sadly, she died sooner than she expected. And so all that she had written was about 1,000 words of a first chapter. So a few characters and a structural idea. And at the time, we shared an editor at our publisher. And the editor brought it to me after I had just finished my trilogy. It's a great big sci-fi trilogy called Chaos Walking. She said, you know, would you consider taking Siobhan's material and turning it into a novel? And my first instinct actually was to say no, because I always worry that if I write a story for anything other than a burning desire to tell a story, that sounds hopelessly noble. I know it does, but I mean, if I'm trying to write something for any external reason, like the satisfaction of a marketplace or an expectation, then just I'm not in it, and the book doesn't live. And so I didn't want to write a memorial, because that's not what Siobhan Dowd would have written. And I worried that the worst possible outcome of this would be to write a bad book. So I was going to say no, but then I looked at her opening chapter, and it's that thing. The thing you always want, the thing that you know when an idea is working for me, is when it starts to sprout other ideas, almost involuntarily. And the very first idea I had is a fulcrum scene of the book and of the film, where Connor, I didn't know what it was, but at the time he comes out of maybe either a dream or a vision, I didn't know what it was, to discover that in the sort of repressed anger that he has about his mother being ill, he has destroyed his grandmother's sitting room without knowing it. And that felt to me exactly right. That felt to me all the power that I sensed in the story, the feeling of transgression, of taboo, of no going back from this transgression. And I thought, that's it. That's an idea. I've got that. This idea is, there's power here and richness here, and I can maybe turn it into something.
Yes, it's a very strong scene. This is a boy, he's 12, yes?
Yes.
And his name is Connor O'Malley. His mother is close to death of cancer. And he and his mother share the dialogue of cure. Mm. They have a new medicine they want to try. They've been having this conversation for so long that Connor has become one of those children who replaces his sick mother. He's up first thing in the morning. He washes the dishes. He does the washing. He prepares things to be hung out on the line. He cooks his own breakfast. And so he would seem to be a self-contained young man, but what he is in addition is someone pent up with anxiety and rage and terrible sorrow. His father has left. He's been gone for 6 years, living in America with another wife, a wife who is not very willing to let her husband get away to visit. And so Connor is shut down and pent up in almost every imaginable way. And we're not even talking about school. There are two things basically going on at school.
He's bullied at school there, and bullying is, you know, since time immemorial, since there have been children, there have been bullying. In modern age, bullies can follow you into your bedroom on social media, and they can, you know, there are no safe places. And Connor faces a bully called Harry, who in a perverse way is the only one who treats him normally still. And so it's that paradox. It's a bully who's aggressive and punishing and punitive and dangerous, but he's also the only one who still sees Connor as a normal kid rather than somebody who needs to be treated with kid gloves.
And the other thing that's happening is happening with the teachers. They're treating him with preternatural sympathy. They don't demand that he do his homework. They let him sit and daydream in the classroom, and they don't call on him. They think what's happening to him, he's becoming, as a result, invisible when he most needs to be developing an identity.
Yeah, and that to me felt like the most tragic aspect of it, because nobody here acts in a way that seems ill thought out or poorly chosen. Everyone is trying to act with the most compassion, but the aggregate result is he's got no outlet. He's got no one to speak to. No one will actually. It's that terrible, terrible position of being a clever child who can figure out 95% of what's going on. But it's that extra 5% where you fill in the blanks, often incorrectly, that are the killer, that are corrosive and poisonous.
I identified very deeply with him. Was he always bullied, or did his behavior change with his mother's illness?
I've always thought that it was the latter, that there are levels of bullying, there are levels of aggression. And I always thought that it became a more serious thing once his mother became ill. And it's almost like a wound you keep poking at, even though you know you shouldn't.
And it's that other worst thing, a girl who's been his best friend and whose mother is his mother's best friend. Well, they spread the word around about the mother's illness, so Connor doesn't have any privacy about it. Everyone at school knows that Connor needs compassion.
Yeah.
And it gets to be pretty terrible. Now, I had Neil Gaiman on the show when he had published his edition of Hansel and Gretel, which was, like your book A Monster Calls, the illustrations were all in black and white, and the version of the story involved starvation and all sorts of terrors that were completely beside the scary witch. Mm-hmm. It was childhood. It was getting lost in the woods. And we were talking about what level of misery is appropriate for children. He said children need it. Children love it. They need to hear about the world, and they sense it instinctively. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
I agree with that, and I often get asked about challenging material in this book and my other books, and my argument has always been that first, if you read what children write themselves, particularly if you read what teenagers write themselves, if you read their own fiction, it is far darker than anything that any YA book would ever be allowed to contain. And so if you are not addressing those things, and if you aren't acknowledging the reality of them, then I feel you're leaving the young reader to face it on their own, which to me is the immoral choice. You know, let's engage with it. Fine, you're thinking about it. I certainly thought about it when I was a child, and nobody would speak to me about it. And that bind can be extremely destructive, because you're left with it by yourself.
I'm talking to Patrick Ness, the author of A Monster Calls, a marvelous children's book, which will be coming out as a movie for this Christmas season. Now, your monster is a remarkable figure. Well, you describe him, would you?
Well, in plot terms, one night at the very beginning of the novel opens, a monster comes to Connor's window. And it's there's a yew tree in a cemetery behind his house, and the yew tree comes to life, forms this monster, and stomps to his house and demands that Connor listen to three stories that the tree is going to tell. And in return, Connor is required to tell a fourth, which would be the truth of his story. And the monster is... I've worked very hard to never fully establish 100% the reality of the monster, the quote-unquote reality of the monster. There is evidence for, there is evidence against. But he is many things, and he needs to be many things. And so he is the original green man from English myth, you know, the landscape personified. He's also perhaps a father figure, if Connor's lacking one, though I think that's sort of psychologically on the nose a little bit. It's also possibly Connor calling parts of himself. And I think I prefer a book, and I prefer a story, even as a kid, where that definition could be slippery. I loved things that slipped and slid between meanings and genres. So the monster is all those things and none of those things at any given time.
But what I loved this monster for was that his job in the book is not only to tell stories, but to teach Connor what a story is. And that a story is not the thing necessarily that the teacher is asking for when she asks the class to do life stories. Mm-hmm. And everyone knows, of course, that Connor is in too much pain to write about what's happening in his life, so he doesn't do one. It's the monster who's going to get Connor's story, but only after he teaches Connor about stories. What does the monster teach?
He teaches what I always asked about when I was a child, which is what happens before the story starts and what happens after it ends. I was never satisfied with the boundaries of, was it really happily ever after? Were there financial problems? But that's glib. But more seriously, I was always and still I'm fascinated by, one, the function of stories, which is if reality doesn't have its own intrinsic value, it has no external meaning. We have to apply meaning to it, and we do it because we are human. We do it in the form of a story, which is a fascinating thing that we do. It's absolutely fascinating to sort out the universe.
Now, he tells Connor that stories are wild. Mm-hmm. And everyone tells you this. But then he tells a story that is wild. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's a bucking bronco. You can't saddle it. It changes direction 3 or 4 times, and it changes its morals over and over again so that Connor can't guess who's the hero? Who's the good guy? Who's the bad guy? What happens next? What happens after? And the monster tells him...
That's not always a good guy or a bad guy. Most of us are somewhere in between. You know, and to live with that complexity, to live with that kind of chaos, I believe is what makes us adult. That step from... I think the journey from innocence is a journey into complexity, and to acknowledge that you can hold contradictory thoughts and still somehow survive, and in the jarring, the compromises we have to make to live day by day, it's a wonder that we're not crazy all the time.
Yes, and what's great here is that the monster really teaches Connor something that is so complicated to render in stories, but in life, the bully in Connor's life is both a bad guy and a very good guy. Mm-hmm. He's the only character who kind of sees into Connor and offers the possibility of a future of some kind, some strange friendship that Connor's never known. Mm-hmm. It's kind of amazing to have a young adult book that says that goofy things, stories are powerful, and then actually makes good and demonstrates that. Now, in the movie, those stories come across very wonderfully, too. They're presented as animations, and they really do play by offering another world within the movie, a visual world that's animated, rather than the giant who is something like King Kong. What's that process called by which they animate that giant?
Motion capture.
Yeah. It he's spectacular.
Yeah, really.
He's really good, and he's played by Liam Neeson, and that voice. I mean, if monsters are supposed to scare you, that voice is addictive.
Yeah.
So Connor gets addicted to being scared by the monster.
Yeah.
It's kind of a wonderful partnership.
There's the monster in particular. I really believe that there's a difference between kind and nice.
And kind, what is it?
Kind is way better than nice. And you can be nice without being at all kind. And I think that is a really interesting sort of villainy, to be polite and nice but have no kindness behind you. But the reverse is also true and extremely compelling. The monster is, I think, not at all nice. He doesn't care that Connor gets into trouble. He doesn't care that there's destruction. But there's kindness there. And that to me is interesting. That to me is kind of heartbreaking. I find I can handle difficult times and I can handle difficult situations. Kindness, you know, knock me down at the knees. I find it really hard to take sometimes. And that's the situation with the monster, this great, big, massive, powerful, terrifying, scary monster. Then offering a moment of kindness, I wouldn't know what to do. I'd fall apart.
The monster is telling him, I'm not here to save your mother. I'm here because you called me, and it's your job to figure out why you called me. That's really scary.
It is, and the thing that I particularly made me, it still makes me panic. And even when you see, in fact, when you just said earlier on, when you were talking about what happens at the school, and you said, and you were telling me, there are two things that happen in the school, and one of them is, and you threw it over to me, and my immediate instinct was, oh my God, what if I get it wrong? You know? Even though it's my book. So it's still there, that panic.
Oh, yes. It's an inevitable feeling. Yeah. When you finish answering a question, I'm in a panic. What is the next question? What if I don't know what to say next? Yeah. Well, what I say next is I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Patrick Ness about his book, A Monster Calls. We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Patrick Ness about his book, A Monster Calls, a prize-winning young adult novel that won prizes both for the book itself and its illustrations, the tale of a boy grappling with the most terrifying thing of all, profound loss. Now, this book gets made into a movie, and you've written the screenplay. I'm curious, is there a point, because at that point, you're suddenly following other people's orders, hearing their opinion, getting suggestions about where the story ought to go. And there are things that make the book very different from the movie, ultimately. How did you feel about that?
I took lots of early meetings. There was movie interest in the book, which is always, you know, fun and flattering. I lived in LA for 10 years, so I was constantly meeting people meeting waiters who had Brad Pitt attached to their scripts, you know, so I never took it extremely seriously. It's, you know, it's pleasant, it's fun. Better to have it than not. But even in the early meetings, I would hear occasionally, not all the time, but I would hear occasionally suggestions of how it might be changed and how it might be softened in particular. And that I resisted that, and I could feel the strain there. I thought, I feel like I know why the book works, if it works, and I could see how it could easily be changed so to work less well. And I had rules when I wrote the book for myself, because I never wanted to lean on the easy cliches of, you know, of a parent dying. No one says I love you in the book. And so the challenge was to infuse the book with love without leaning on the simple crutch of someone saying I love you in a cheap way. No one says cancer in the book. There's no hugs in the book. There's one comedy hug in the book. And so it was a whole, a concerted effort to get away from what I call pretty crying. I didn't want elegant tear down the cheek. You know, I wanted, if you were going to cry, I wanted it to be ugly crying, because anything else felt like a lie. And so when the movie came about, I thought, well, I'm not a filmmaker, but why don't I at least start the conversation and say, these are the things that are important to me. So I didn't sell the book. I had no connection to a studio or a filmmaker. I just wrote the script on spec. And I thought, this is a risk. Nobody may be interested, but at least I can say that I have said my piece. This is what I value, and this is why, what I think is powerful in the story. Because the book is illustrated, and there are breathtaking illustrations by an illustrator called Jim Kay, who was then, because of this book, he was handpicked by J.K. Rowling to be the Harry Potter illustrator. And he's the loveliest man in the world. I always have to say that, because he genuinely is. Because of that, and because of that, I had taken this from the idea of Siobhan Dowd, it's an unusual collaborative book. And so I could see, particularly with Jim, the things that an illustrator brought that I could never possibly think of, and how the two of us together make something larger than our own individual contributions. And so a movie is like that 100 times over, with the added benefit that the book is done, that the book is finished, and the book remains. And I genuinely believe that book, the book will stay. Whatever happens with the movie, I'll work as hard as I can to make the movie as good as I can. I'm really proud of the movie, but the book remains, and it's its own thing. And the movie doesn't cancel it. The movie doesn't erase it from history or replace it. That the book stays. And that gave me a feeling of freedom when I made the adaptation, because, you know, a movie is not a book. It seems simple to say, but it genuinely isn't.
Tell me about the director. He's one of the new generation of Spanish directors. Yep. What is his name?
Juan Antonio Bayona.
And this is his third feature film?
Yes, after The Orphanage and The Impossible.
You got the right director. The previous works are very much in the line,
yes,
of this book.
Mm-hmm.
And you could see why he would like the book very much. Mm-hmm. Now, I did feel, people will feel different ways when I say this, but I did feel the movie softened the book. And some people will sigh in relief, saying, oh, I can bring the kids then. and other people will say, well, a book should never be softened. Yeah. I'm of the latter feeling. Mm. How did you feel?
I don't feel that it does. I genuinely don't. I think the movie, because visual medium is entirely different in how we react to it. And also, a movie is a single encapsulated experience. You can't put it down like a book. And so it has different things that it needs to accomplish. And I think it hits really quite hard. I mean, the audiences I've seen it with are quite weepy at the end. And they approach me in that spirit. And again, I would really go with sad but not bleak. I think it's quite hopeful at the end. But I don't feel that it softens. I think we avoid a lot of the cheapening of it. And I think the visuals provide an atmosphere where you can feel not safe, but, you know, well guided. But I think the pain that he feels is still true. And it's interesting what you said about I can take the kids to it. Absolutely with the book, and now with the film, but absolutely with the book. I got a lot of discussion at the beginning when it was published. I would get maybe a good review and they'd say, but this isn't for kids. And I always disagreed, always, always disagreed. And
I disagreed too, yeah. Definitely. I think for anyone who's trying to tell a kid about loss and how we face sorrow, this would be good. It doesn't have to be for someone dealing with a parent with cancer. It's a story about how we use stories to face the things that worry and frighten and make us anxious. And it tells It's a book that recommends books.
It does, in a way, it does, yeah. And what, how could you object to that?
What is your favorite thing in the film?
My favorite thing in the film my favorite scene in the book is the destruction of the living room, which I think...
The grandmother's living room, yeah. Where he's sent to live.
Yeah, and that terrible feeling in your gut that, oh my God, I've gone too far. What's going to happen? You're really on a precipice. You have no idea what's going to happen next. And it is everything that he's repressing, everything that he desperately needs to say, but no one will give him a chance to say what the monster finally does. It's that. And having said that, I want to add one more thing to that, which is, to me, the book, there's one line in the book where he says to the monster, very, very near the end, he asks if the monster will stay. You know, up to the moment that we understand, up to the moment of his mother's death. And the line is in the movie as well, that you'll stay. And to me, that's the entire book, 200 pages in one line. Like all kids, he's a clever kid. Kids understand way more than we give them credit for. They are taught not to talk, but they're taught to, they are taught to play childlike and to say, no, I don't understand, even when they do. He knows what's going to happen. He knows he can get through it. He just doesn't want to do it by himself. And to me, that is utterly heartbreaking. And the fact that the monster says, I will stay, that's all he wants. And to me that I get moved even talking about it. You know, that's all I wanted as a kid, someone to say, no, no, I know it's hard, but I'll be here.
I loved the monster.
Me too.
I thought his construction and his every aspect was extraordinary. As he stands and straightens, he shrugs off the vegetation that's clinging to his back as he pulls his arms and shoulders back and becomes this wood creature. He is enormous. He is identified with the night. He's just beautifully done. And Liam Neeson provides the perfect voice for this amazing... construction. I've been talking with Patrick Ness about his book, A Monster Calls, and inevitably about the movie A Monster Calls, which is coming out for the Christmas season. Thank you very much, Patrick, for joining me.
Thank you for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from A Monster Calls at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to David Sobel, my assistant. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Colson Whitehead is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.